And they told them how all the workers are looking up to Stakhanov, how they love him. Imagine the workers looking up to someone that's the Judas goat. And the Communist Party members just fell for it and so forth. I'll read a little section here of how they talked in the Soviet Union. Of how the bureaucrats talked, with Stalin as their spokesman. In January 1934 came the 17th Congress. Stalin delivered a long report. Quotes, "It must be admitted that the toiling peasantry, our Soviet peasantry, has completely and irrevocably come under the red flag of socialism." The peasants are completely under the red flag of socialism. Didn't Khrushchev say that the Soviet Union was confronted with a terrible agricultural crisis? And to this very day, Soviet production doesn't come up to 1913. If it does, it's just a little over. That's about all. It has never made a comeback because the peasantry can't be forced to produce. That simple ABC that Engels talked about and that Trotsky and Lenin talked about. Now, then Stalin goes on and explains how fascism is completely bankrupt in Germany. Completely bankrupt. With the help of revolution in the West, Russia has a great future, and even without that revolution has won and still wins great successes. Well, you know the successes they won. They're completely isolated. And the only way now they can get into any kind of an agreement with the imperialists is for to come to terms at the terms that the imperialists laid down. We might say that at this period, 1933, 1934, because of these internal reforms inside the Soviet Union, Russian communism has reached the point of no return. There is no return to the revolutionary road. Without an internal political revolution, not a social revolution, but a political revolution against the bureaucracy and the wiping of it out. Stalinism now rules supreme, 100%, and the political counter-revolution has triumphed, 100%. I told of how in 1934, Hitlerism was approached by Stalinism to make an alliance with the Soviet Union, and they got the brush off. If you go back and read the bound volumes of the Militants, you'll see there where Trotsky, we found this out through some means or other, I don't know how, but the old man found that out, and he wrote the lead article in the Militants that week, saying how Stalinism is trying to connive an agreement behind the backs of the democratic capitalists to make an alliance with the Soviet Union. Well, the Stalinists agreed that, well, this is more crap by counter-revolutionary Trotskyism. At the same time, when after being rejected by Hitlerism for an alliance, Stalinism suddenly raises the banner of collective security for the democracy. All the peace-loving, democratic people in the world should unite against this monster Hitler. And side by side with this, as I said, they're feeling out various imperialist countries underneath the board, and in September 1934, they joined the League of Nations. Now, what was the League of Nations? The League of Nations was set up by the victorious imperialists under the leadership of the American imperialists in 1919 to regulate the entire world and to lead a struggle against world communism. That's what the League of Nations was set up for. It barred the Soviet Union from membership. Was anything more open? Nothing could be more open. What is the United Nonsense today? The same thing. It's an organization that has declared war on communist China. And the Soviet Union is in on it because it was in on the ground floor believing, when it was founded in San Francisco during the World War, believing that the United States was going to help restore and rehabilitate industry in the Soviet Union, industry that had been destroyed by Hitlerism, the Hitler armies. And the Soviet Union is sitting in there on the Security Council, absolutely powerless, because one member can veto any other policy put forth by the other four. So the whole thing is a joke. But it is used to crucify communist China. And the same thing was in the League of Nations. Well, 1934, the Soviet Union was admitted to membership in the League of Nations. In other words, they had maneuvered, and the king comes to terms with the American imperialists and the rest of the world imperialists underneath the board, made concessions, came to an understanding, and then publicly was admitted in the League of Nations. And not only that, but the United States Capitol had recognized the Soviet Union previous to that in February of 1933. The Roosevelt government came in and recognized the Soviet Union. Now, Roosevelt was a very able American politician. He was not the average run of a politician like Dick Johnson or Harry Truman. Newcomers probably are old enough to remember these two individuals. Now, he was a man, an aristocrat, a blue blood, but he understood what the world was and where it was going. That's the important thing about Roosevelt. He was an extremely able politician that knew what the score was. That's what it was. He knew that the world was divided into working class and capitalist class. And that's something that the average American politician doesn't know to this very day. Kennedy, that was assassinated, was also of the same school. He knew that the world was divided into working class and capitalist class. He got his education at the London School of Economics, the leading capitalist economic school in the world. Not only that, but he was a cosmopolitan person. He knew what European politics was, and he knew that he understood the class struggle. These men are doubly dangerous to us because they know what's what. And it was under Roosevelt's influence that the United States turned around and recognized the Soviet Union. Up to this time, from the Russian Revolution to 1933, the United States had nothing to do with the Soviet Union, any more than they had anything to do with China. They don't recognize China. They recognize the tiny little island that the Kuomintang gangsters took over from the Formosans and renamed it Tijuana, or whatever the hell, Tijuana, I guess, some foolish thing. But they took that over with by slaughtering the natives of Formosa. At the same time, they started to ease off this wild-eyed ultra-leftism of labeling everybody as a fascist that wasn't a member of the Communist Party. In other words, the theory of social fascism started to be played down a little. And they started to glorify great men, world saviors, people that were equal to Karl Marx, I guess, and Lenin, like Franklin Roosevelt. He was a great man, so he loved everybody, especially the Communist Party and the Soviet Union. Well, the rapprochement of the Soviet Union and the United States gave a great impetus to rapprochement with the imperialists in Europe and the Soviet Union. And in May 1935, out of a clear sky, came the announcement of the creation of a People's Front in France. Now, what's a People's Front? It's a nice, cute name for a united front. It's nothing but a united front. And the Stalinists came to this because of their agitation with the triumph of Hitler, their constant agitation that all peace-loving individuals, parties, countries, and so forth and so on, must unite against the barbaric Hitlerism. And in France, they formed the United Front with the Socialist Party, the Second International, and, pardon me, a party called the Radical Socialists, which Trotsky said is neither radical nor socialist. Now, up until the time that the Gaulle took over in France, they had what they call proportional representation. And they still have it under de Gaulle, but it's a little walk now. Because his gang requires, say, 10 votes for everyone that the working class gets in the Communist Party and so forth before they can amount to anything. But they have proportional representation. Now, France has a peculiar economic setup. It's only in the last 10 years that France has become, by majority, an industrial country. It has always been a majority petty bourgeois agricultural country, having the best soil in Europe, best productive soil in Europe. And its economic laws, many of which were laid down by the French Revolution, the French bourgeois revolution of 1792, protecting the small businessman, the small agriculturist, and so forth. So that to this day, France is made up of millions and millions of small farmers and small businessmen. And the laws, as I say, are on the books to protect them against the development of huge big corporations like we have in the United Front. In the United States, rather. Jesus, on my mind. So anyway, this in France, where you have this proportional representation, every politician and his brother went into business with a political party. But the Radical Socialist Party was the spokesman for the small businessman and a large section of the peasantry. Then you had the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, I don't know how many others. John probably knows the other 45 parties. But of all of the parties, the Radical Socialist was the most corrupt. As Trotsky said at one time, that the French politics, French bourgeois politics, are the most corrupt politics in the world. Everything is for sale. The programs don't mean anything. If you can't get your way in one party, you go into business and set up a party of your own. So you use as blackmail against some other party. So there's no stability to political affairs in France. And the crisis had broken in 1934 in February over a hot shop scandal. In France, it's the custom for working people to be in hock all the time, running down to the hock shop. Is that right, John? Is that kind of a... It's for the pawnbrokers. The big scandal in February 1933 was the Stavisky scandal, where this man got control of a whole gang of pawnbroking shops throughout France. And I don't know just how it happened, but he couldn't pay off. And this led to an attempt by the fascists to take over the government in France. Up to this time, the fascists didn't amount to a row of pins. There were a half a dozen organizations of fascists, and the main one was the Cross of Fire. And they attempted in February to take over the government. And the only ones that opposed them were the rank-and-file workers. There was no political leadership whatsoever against this attempt by the French Nazis, French fascists, to take over the government. Well, under the pressure of these developments came an impetus to the Communist Party to form some kind of United Front, and they did. And out of it came the Popular Front of the Radical Socialist Party, which in the last 5 years was continually losing votes and losing members in the Chamber of Deputies to one election after another. In other words, French society was starting to line up in classes. A lot of these small parties were driven out of business, and the French population started to line up for capitalism or for socialism. And that can be observed very easily in any of these countries where you'll have a parliamentary setup, like in England. Now, they did the same in Spain, but we'll confine ourselves to France, and what happened in France was only duplicated in Spain. Now, all of the parties were distrustful of Stalinism. They knew that the Stalinist leaders in their respective countries were only robots, that they were summoned to Moscow, and they were told what to say, and when they went back to their countries, they were Charlie McCarty's. That's all. They repeated what they were told, and if they were told to stay down with the government, they said down with the government. If they said away for the government, if they were told to say that, that's what they said. So they must prove their sincerity. That was, it's the old story, the thief yelling stop thief. Well, the Stalinists had been pointing out very carefully to anybody that was stupid enough to listen to them that the socialists were really fascists. Well, you don't believe in socialism, they're really fascists. Roosevelt is a fascist, you know. The leaders of the American Federation of Labor are fascists. Well, now they want you to say, instead of that, they want you to say, hooray for Roosevelt, he's the God Savior of the world. The American Federation of Labor is led by, oh boy, what clean living chaps, devoting their whole life to the working class. You're supposed to say just the opposite. Well, the Stalinists, having a guilty complex, went the whole hog. And they froth at the mouth, they roll themselves up in the red, white, and blue of France, the tricolor in France. In the United States, they used to wrap themselves up in the American flag every day and whoop it up for American imperialism. He looks at American imperialism, not American capitalism, but American imperialism. And their main slogan was collective security. That was their main slogan. And all peace-loving people, British, French, and Americans, and the Russians should get together and wipe this terrible scourge of Hitlerism off the globe. And don't forget, while they were trying to make these deals with the American capitalists and the French capitalists and the British capitalists to show that they're good boys and that they really mean business and they aren't revolutionaries anymore, they were carrying on this terrible struggle inside the Soviet Union to prove that we aren't revolutionaries anymore. Don't you see what we did? We just abolished the Society for All Bolsheviks. Oh, speed up. Hey, we'll show you speed up. Friends, send your engineers over to our country. We'll show you how to speed up the workers. Sure. Oh, collectivization in the farms? No. We never allowed. We know never for that. Didn't Comrade Stalin take some of those out and shoot them that collectivized the farms? Everything was turned upside down. In other words, the rank and file of the Communist Party was running. They were politically punch drunk. That's what they actually were. They were politically punch drunk and didn't know what the hell they were believing or what they weren't believing. They didn't know what to believe from day to day. All they knew was one thing, that Trotskyism was counter-revolution. And if you got any decent blood in your body, you'll try to cut one of their throats. That's the only way you can get into heaven. Allah be praised. Now a thing happened, before we get into the People's Front in France, an event happened in Russia in December 1934. That was the assassination of a man named Kirov. Kirov was the leader of the Petrograd Communist Party. And he was assassinated by a young man who had been expelled from the YCL in the Soviet Union. And then it was announced that his collaborators and himself were executed within 4 or 5 days, and so forth and so on. Then, 10 or 15 days later, they discovered that Kamenev and Zinoviev, the former opponents of Stalin, who at one time were in the left opposition with Trotsky, were morally responsible for what happened, inspiring this young man to bump off Kirov. Then the news leaked out that Kirov had, that this young man had entered the buildings where Kirov had his office, had entered the buildings where Kirov lived, had his offices, a couple of days before that, and hadn't been stopped, but Kirov wasn't in at that time. And one thing after the other. Well, Trotsky wrote a pamphlet, we may have some here, a reprint of it, in which he proved, in 1934, he proved conclusively that Stalin was the one that had Kirov bumped off. And why? We didn't know at that time, but since then, from all these confessions of ex-Stalinists, and Khrushchev himself said so, Kirov had seized some freight trains with food and directed that they be brought into Petersburg to feed the Petersburg workers. There was such a shortage of food in Petrograd that Kirov, disobeying the orders of the leadership of the Communist Party of Stalin, had taken his food and given it to the workers in Petrograd. And he was a great hero of the workers in Petrograd. And it was revealed later that he was the main obstacle to Stalin in the pushing towards execution of the opponents that had been sent to Siberia, the left oppositionists and the right oppositionists. And that Stalin was jealous of his growing popularity. And Trotsky, in this little pamphlet, said that this is the beginning of a bloodbath in the Soviet Union, and it cannot stop until all of Stalin's opponents are wiped out. Now,
Look, today you can sit down and say, well, that sounds logical. But I can remember in those days when we read the papers, and Jesus Christ, the old man says that this is the beginning, huh? Stalin will never bump off his friends for the last 30 years and so forth that went through the Russian Revolution and so forth, 1905 and so on. It's hard to believe. But he did, as we know, in the Moscow trial. But this was the pretext for Stalin and Stalinism in the Soviet Union to open up on its political opponents. A wild-eyed campaign was started up all over the world, not only in the Soviet Union, but all over the world, explaining the dangers of Trotskyism, which was counter-revolution and a tool of the Japanese and German imperialists. Not the American imperialists, because they were good imperialists. And this fitted right into the turn that the Communist International and the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was making at that time. So let's get a few dates. In February 1933, the United States recognizes the Soviet Union. In September 1934, a year and a half later, the Soviet Union enters the League of Nations, or as Lenin called it, the Den of Thieves. Lenin would no more think of agreeing to enter the League of Nations than joining the man on the moon, I guess, to go on a hunting expedition. Now Lenin would say, it's a bourgeois organization. What the hell do we want in there for? It's a den of thieves. All they're interested in is suppressing the world revolution and carving the world up among themselves. The bigger ones will eat up the little ones if they get a chance, and that's what happened. Then in February 1934 came the collapse of the pawnbroking outfits in France. And incidentally, during their demonstrations led by the workers themselves, the rank and file workers, against the fascists from taking over in France in 1934, the pressure was on the rank and file of the communists to do something about it. So what did the Stalinist party do? They led a demonstration with the fascists against the government, demanding that the government do something against the pawnbrokers, against Stavinsky and his gang. They find the police finally got it caught up with Stavinsky, and they used the old French method of shooting him in the head because he tried to escape. He was in the pay of the big politicians, and dead men tell no tales, so they bumped him off. That's a part of French culture. Isn't that right, John? It is, right? Sure, no. Our French man here. But that's a system in France to bump off somebody because he's paid off the politicians. Just like in the United States, they bump off somebody that's been passing out the graft. Tell you, they're not going to let the guy talk. So bump him off, they try to escape. Then in May 1935 came the Franco-Soviet Pact. Now at that time, the Premier of France was a very honest man named Laval, Pierre Laval. He controlled a large section of the houses of prostitution in Paris. He was a God-fearing Roman Catholic, of course. He'd sell his mother to a whorehouse if he could make a dime on her. He was buggers over money. And he executed the Franco-Soviet Pact, in which the Soviet Union promised to defend France against an attack by the German Nazis. And the French capitalist government promised to defend the Soviet Union against an attack by German Nazism, provided. That's what the motto was. French capitalism didn't promise anything of a decisive nature. But the Russian communists were in such a state of terror, of looking for allies, that they were willing to go to any length to make some kind of an alliance or a semblance of an alliance with any of the imperialist powers. Well, when this pact was signed, the Communist Party didn't waste any time in preaching the fact that anybody that agitated against the development of the French armed forces, was an agent of Hitlerism. Anybody that agitated for any kind of disturbances in the industrial setup, strikes and so forth, was an agent of Hitler. They whipped it up 100% all over, up and down France. And they openly proclaimed the disowning of any revolutionary developments in France. and they denounced anybody that was in favor of any kind of a social revolution in France. In 1935, to prove that they meant business and to prove to the capitalists throughout the world that they were no longer revolutionaries, they sold oil to Mussolini in the invasion of Abyssinia, of Ethiopia. Mussolini wanted to grab off a few honors and to prove to the Italian people that the glories of Rome were being resurrected. So he opened up an attack on this poor defenseless kingdom in the upper Nile, and the Russian government sold oil so that he'd have oil for his war machine. I can remember those days as plain as day, talking to Stalin, and he'd say, well, what about it?
Well, you know, the business or whatever, you can get it, you know. Well, if he didn't sell it to that camp, we can sell it to the other camp. Well, you know, I said, okay, I'll see you later, goodbye.
You couldn't talk to reason with any of these people. These Stalinists, as I said, existed purely on faith, nothing else. While the capitalists still wanted some proof that these boys meant business, that they weren't a bunch of fakers. And by God, they were going to show proof that they weren't a bunch of fakers. Not only that, but they strengthened their rule in the Soviet Union. And how would they show that they meant business and that they weren't any longer revolutionaries? They'd prove it by taking out the old revolutionaries and using them for sibs, human sibs, and that's what they did. They executed, the Moscow trials, how they took the flower of Lenin's party after being persecuted for 10, 12 years, after being in exile for 10 years and so, took these men and women and just executed them in the Moscow trials. In those days, we didn't know how the hell they could ever get these men to come to trial and admit the terrible things that they had to admit. But since then, we found out through these confessions by these various bureaucrats that Stalin secret police would get a hold of these individuals and tell them how to dance. And if they wouldn't dance, they'd say, well, you know, we got some nice children. Gee, it'd be pretty bad, huh? If they were a guy, huh? Wouldn't it be tough, huh? Gee, and your wife, huh? You like your wife, huh? Yeah, it'd be terrible if she was put on trial, wouldn't it, huh? And you know, we have a law that children 12 years of age and over can be executed in our socialist country. You wouldn't want your little children to be executed, would you? Okay, give me any goddamn thing, I'll sign it. And I said, I want it. These men and women were hounded into trying to save their families. And they were willing to dance to say any goddamn thing that this brute demanded. Well, they wiped out the whole Bolshevik party. The old leadership of the party was now exterminated, and they had proven to world imperialism that they no longer believed in this nonsense of socialism and so forth and so on. Well, now in France, while they're fishing around and they set up the People's Front, you know, in Spain. In the United States, anybody that looked cockeyed at Roosevelt was now a counter-revolutionary scum, an agent of Hitler, and so forth. Communism is now 20th century Americanism. They had a Charlie Chaplin, the leader of the party, a real browder, had a little dinky mustache, looked like Hitler when you doctored up his picture. And this clown used to run all over the country at public meetings. The Stalinists would have, in Boston here, would have run a public meeting, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 people. Here up in Boston Arena, they filled it one time when Browder spoke in 1938. And we had a couple of comrades assigned to go into the meeting. And we had, 30 comrades outside selling the militants, tightly sold militants, five months old to these people. They didn't know any difference. We sold hundreds and hundreds of militants, and to divert from the subject of the lecture, so I'll give you an idea what the Communist Party was like in those days. It's hard to believe. You think I might be lying to you. But you can ask Johnny Tabor, Johnny Keeley, in New York. He's tugged along. He was a literature agent in those days. Geez, a big Cadillac that's full of. Out in a uniformed chauffeur, open the door, out would come a couple of comrades.
Jesus Christ. And all the stupid professors were there. See, each one knowing less and less about politics. Oh, Jesus.
Well, when he took up a collection, and it cost $100 bills, you should have seen the snowstorm from the balcony. Two balconies at the old Boston Arena. They just came floating down. I can imagine our comrades there. What do you say to a bucket of collection? Our comrades, my eyes must have popped out of their heads. But this was regular, and Browder would explain how we must support Roosevelt because he's a great man, he's a Democrat, and so forth and so on.